Ladies and gentlemen, welcome, welcome. Welcome to Women of the World Festival in Hull. I'm Henrietta, I'm one of the exec producers at Hull 2017. And I'm going to talk to you a little bit now, which is a way of warming up the room and making sure that everybody knows what's going to be going on and encouraging people to come through. So we're just about to have an extraordinary session now where we welcome many of our Hull trailblazers. You've been watching our film up there on the screen. Just while we're getting final preparations for that, I wanted to make sure that you'd all seen the amazing flowers that have been installed here in the hall. Have you all spied the amazing Mohican down in the lobby? If you haven't seen the Mohican, then you've still got some joy to discover. All sorts of interventions have taken place. I haven't been into the men's loos, but I do know there's some surprises in the ladies' loos. So hopefully there's some surprises in the men's loos too. Perhaps I'll have to go and have a search. They've been created by an amazing woman called Kirsty Werdingham, who is the creative designer at JZ Flowers. JZ Flowers are a company based here in Hull. They started out with one van doing a Dutch run between Hull and Holland, bringing flowers over. They're now a over £100 million business and working nationally and internationally, and another success story of Hull. But Kirsty's done an extraordinary job interpreting the theme of anything is possible, which was very fitting for this festival. If you haven't already, then I'd like you to just check your program, because we have other fantastic performances coming up later in the day. Gemma Kearney is on stage at 2 o'clock in conversation with Kofi Smiles about her new book, Open, The Magic and Messed Up Ways of Life. And Kate Fox will be performing her brand new show called The Wrong Bits. It's all about body image and her sense of body image. But a very, very funny take on that. There's a session just finishing now with Kate and Gemma in the other room, and that audience will be, I'm sure, wandering through shortly. And just to reiterate, if you haven't spotted already, the Waterstones pop-up bookshop is in the information hall, and one of our Wow Bites people will be signing there after the session. So Val Wood will be signing after the session, and Gemma will be signing after the session at 3 o'clock. So Gemma is on at 2. Her session runs from 2 till 3. She'll be signing at 3 at the Waterstones. Right, I think we're just about ready. So I'm going to hand over now, if that's okay, to our new our panel. This is our Wow Bites selection. So it's a smorgasbord, an opportunity to have the chance to meet some amazing women who have achieved extraordinarily different things through their lives. And I'm going to let Anna Farthing, who is hosting the session, take you through and introduce you to all of our wonderful Wow Bite panelists. There's a tongue twister. Anna, the floor is yours. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Henrietta. There's so many wonderful things going on today, and there's some amazing women here. We're about to hear from 4 incredible women who have wonderful stories to tell. Wow Bites is about sharing stories, sharing experience, asking questions, making provocations. So we haven't told these ladies what to talk about. They've got their own, they've got 10 minutes of space to fill with whatever they wish. I'm just going to introduce who we have here, first of all. So to my far left, we have Leanne Bell. Leanne is a freelance set designer and project manager for the arts who lives in Dublin. She's come over here today, but last year she unexpectedly spearheaded hashtag Waking the Feminists, which is a major campaign in Ireland for equality for women in theatre. And Leanne's going to tell us a little bit about that. To my immediate left, we have Dr. Karen Briggs, MBE. She is a 4-times judo world champion, a 2-times Commonwealth Games champion, and she's been inducted into the Judo Hall of Fame in 2015. She is the only great British woman to so far receive this honour, and Karen is now coaching 300 people a week in schools, half of which are girls. To my immediate right, we have Val Wood. Val Wood, you may know if you've read her, much loved author of historic romantic novels. She's written 22 novels, all set in and around Hull and the East Riding of Yorkshire. Val was born in Castleford. I'm saying Castleford because I'm a Southerner and I was otherwise told not to say Castleford. and now lives in the market town of Beverley. Her first novel, The Hungry Tide, was published in 1993 after winning the Catherine Cookson Prize for Romantic Fiction. Val has released many novels that have been named in the Sunday Times bestseller list, including The Doorstep Girls. Now, to my far, far right, a face you may recognise, Nancy Birtwistle. Nancy was born and raised and educated in Hull and the surrounding area. She was married and had her children in her 20s. In her 30s, she qualified to compete at Crufts Dog Obedience. In her 40s, she studied at Hull University and obtained an MBA. In her 50s, she retired from a 32-year career in the NHS. And as you may know, she won the Great British Bake Off at 60. Nancy will be talking to us about what next. So could you first of all please welcome our panel? So first up, we're going to hear from Leanne Bell, who's come from Dublin, to tell us a little bit about hashtag Waking the Feminists. Over to you, great. Leanne. Thank you.
Hello. Here, I'm going to stand up. So I've been given 10 minutes, and my general theme to talk about is becoming an accidental activist. And I thought I'd better write it down, because I've a lot to say. So forgive me for reading, rather than just speaking directly at you. So up until November 2015, I'd never been a campaigner. And while I considered myself a natural feminist, I don't think I'd ever thought about it that hard. Only in the past few years, with a general resurgence of feminist awareness around me, did I start to understand what it actually was. I didn't have that much of a clear idea what sexism was and how it might affect me. It was a slow path to awareness. Still, I did often take part in conversations with friends and colleagues in pubs or over cups of tea about how great women we worked with seemed to be sidelined in theatre, rolling our eyes and getting it off our chests. At the end of October 2015, I was coming to the end of a long year. I'd worked on a few exhausting productions in a row, and I was at the point of wondering, why on earth does anyone make theatre anyway? I was tired, and I was feeling I could quite easily drop the whole thing and move to the south of France to work in a bar, which always sounds like a good idea to me. When I saw the programme announcement in our national theatre, the Abbey Theatre, for its 2016 season, which is called Waking the Nation, I counted the number of women directors, 3 out of 10, and women writers, 1 out of 10, and wrote a Facebook post letting off some steam. Cut to 2 weeks later, to me standing in front of a huge public meeting on the main stage of the National Theatre, which had sold out in 7 minutes. Be careful what you post on Facebook. At that event, 30 women working in theatre took to the stage of the Abbey to give their testimony, not just about the Abbey. It was already clear that the problems were much greater than that, but about bias in all areas of Irish theatre community. The building was bursting at the seams, and the event was live tweeted and live streamed to thousands of people across the world. A movement called Waking the Feminists had begun. It was, without exaggerating, the most important thing to happen to Irish theatre in a generation, if not more. When I talk about the 2 weeks leading up to that event, I can only describe it as lighting a match in a room without realising the room was filled with gas. I spent about 14 hours a day glued to my laptop at home, usually still in my pajamas with a half-eaten bowl of cereal beside me, and I watched gobsmacked as one after another, women who I'd worked with and admired for years began to share their stories and opinions publicly in a way I'd never seen before. I spent the time flicking frantically between my Facebook and Twitter accounts, encouraging people to speak up, taking screen grabs of comments and posts and reposting them. I realized that if I could consolidate all this online noise, the sound might travel a little further, and I was right, it was deafening. I had no idea this was going to happen. I had no idea that within days of my original post, we would start to get tweets of support from the likes of Saoirse Ronan, Deborah Messing, Simon Callow, Martha Plimpton, Gabriel Byrne, Nicole Kidman, and creme de la creme, Meryl Streep. I also had no idea the kind of media frenzy that happens when you get these kinds of tweets. In the lead up to that public event, we had coverage in all the major papers, TV channels, and radio stations in Ireland. So a top tip, befriend Meryl. At the event itself, the amazing and patient woman who became our volunteer press manager asked a group of us, all women, who wanted to be on the 6-1 News, which is Ireland's most watched daily TV news program. And there was deathly silence. Later, she told us that if she'd approached a group of men, she would bet her life that that wouldn't have happened. In the wake of that event, a small group of us, women and men, agreed that we would dedicate 1 year to the campaign to see how far we got. As an unpaid activist, I got to choose my own title, so I became the campaign director. The indescribable energy and solidarity that those few weeks unleashed in our community gave us the impetus, the mandate, and the power to change Irish theatre fundamentally. Cut to now. The public campaign officially closed in November 2016, though there was still quite a lot of work going on behind the scenes. We held 2 more major Waking the Feminists events during the year, as well as encouraging people around the country and internationally to hold their own. We spent the year meeting with the leaders of the major theatre organisations in Ireland and encouraging / coercing them to improve their track record in relation to women artists and theatre workers. We won awards, including being presented with the first ever International Lily Award in New York, which was once again on the 6-1 News. One of our core team was appointed to the board of the National Theatre. Another was appointed to the Arts Council. We conducted groundbreaking research into the gender balance in Irish theatre, which meant we could definitively show that all those stories and testimonies that we'd heard and had kicked off the movement were grounded in a community with a quantifiable bias against women artists. In the Abbey, for example, the National Theatre, only over the last 10 years, only 20% of the productions have been directed by women, and only 17% written by women. Worse still, the second top-funded theatre company in our country, the Gate Theatre, had 8% of female directors and just 6% of female writers in the last 10 years. Thankfully, the Gate is starting to come out from the long shadow of patriarchy, with the first woman artistic director who's taking up the position in a couple of weeks. Not that Waking the Feminists can directly claim credit for that, but I have to say she would have been less likely to have been appointed without the sea change that happened in our community from the campaign. And there was I, someone who'd never led an organization, working alongside some of the most extraordinary and accomplished people in our community, gaining from their insight and knowledge. During that year, I worked harder than I've ever worked before, and I had to squash my natural tendency to shy away from the limelight. As someone who enjoys working backstage, I hadn't ever really spoken publicly before the campaign, and there I was appearing on national television and radio, talking to seminar groups in universities and to conference attendees at the biggest venues in our city. At the last rough count, I've spoken publicly in the last year about 34 times and done 43 media interviews, which is a pretty steep learning curve for me. And the work continues. Our full research report will be coming out in April. A working group that I'm part of has formed from the leaders of the theatre organisations across our country to research and develop gender policy. We're also working with our Minister for the Arts, as she's asking our national cultural institutions, such as the National Gallery, the Library, the Concert Hall, to put gender equality policies in place by 2018, which is the centenary of women's suffrage in Ireland. All that said, the best part of Waking the Feminists for me has been hearing countless stories of individuals who've been changed and uplifted by the movement, seeing people having the growing confidence to call out sexism when they see it, watching as normally behind the scenes women like me take the microphone. From a personal point of view, thanks to the support and encouragement of so many people around me, I've finished the year with greater confidence in my own abilities. I've learned how important it is to encourage and support women to speak up. It gets easier the more you do it, but having someone giving you that little extra push, especially at the beginning, is really important. I'll tell you our big secret. Waking the Feminists was never really about theatre. It's about the roles that women get to play in our society. It's about the stories we get to hear and who gets to tell those stories. It's about where the power lies and the money flows, public money in our case. Most of all, it's about making a significant change in a small but visible and vocal community, a change that continues to radiate outwards. We all experience the effects of an inherited patriarchy. It permeates the fabric of our systems, though it may manifest in different ways. In Ireland, we're regularly reminded that women are not and never have been equal in the eyes of our state. Last week, we got confirmation that the remains of hundreds of babies were found in the grounds of a mother and baby home, apparently having died from disease and neglect between the 1920s and the 1960s. Mother and baby homes were Catholic-run, state-supported institutions for fallen women and their sinful offspring. The last one closed in 1996. The scale of these kind of things around us can feel overwhelming for an individual, whether you consider yourself an activist or not. When you want to do something, you can feel exhausted before you even begin. Trust me, I know. But do something. Start small, wear the badge, write the Facebook post. Find your people and support each other. Don't let the scale of it overwhelm you. There are lots of us just like you, and we've got your back. But do something, because none of us can afford not to. Thanks.
Thank you, Leon. Some wonderful food for thought there. How to be an accidental activist. Our next speaker, I think, may have some, it will build on this in a way. We've talked a lot about not having role models, and when only there's 5%, 6%, 10% of the stories being told in a cultural institution are coming from women's voices, it's difficult to find those role models. And also we're talking a bit about coaching and supporting people. This morning, when we looked at the newspapers, in 11 pages of sport in a major national newspaper, 11 pages of sport, there was no woman. There was no mention of women's sport, and there was no photographs of women. And our next speaker challenges that in every way.
Thank you.
Dr. Karen Briggs, judo champion, learning mentor, and role model. Thank you, Karen.
Thank you. Good afternoon to everybody. I was born in Hull. I was born in Abbey Street, just off Holderness Road, in 1963. I came from a family of six. I was the fifth child. My mum, Elsie, was a housewife. My dad, Albert, was a stevedore on the docks, which during that time, that's where many parents used to work, on the docks. When I was seven, I moved to Bransome, one of the biggest housing estates in the world. And my childhood, may I say, was probably the best that any child could wish for. Played football from morning till night. Had 10p in my pocket, which was probably enough to keep me with food until I went back home. In them days, we could do this. Nowadays, it is very difficult to be able to let our children play. I was a sports mad tomboy. Any sport, didn't matter what, just as long as it was sport. So much energy, my parents put me into everything, tried to get rid of my excess energy. At age of 11, my father took me to the Doc Judo Club. From this day, I never looked back. The coach actually said that I was a natural in my sport of judo. And I remember going over to my dad and saying, what does that actually mean? And I was football mad. Football was my sport. But when I got to the age of 12, I entered a competition in Hull, which was organized by one of the boys' football teams, because he actually thought that his son was going to win this competition. But little did he know, a little scrawny 12-year-old was going to turn up to the competition, which was entered by 1,000 boys, me being the only girl, and I won by doing 1,479 keep me uppies. A trial for Hull City was my prize, but because I was a girl, I was not allowed. So I was given a cheque for £30, which I thought I was rich at this time in my life. £30, I bought a bright orange tracksuit with black stripes, loved it. It was my Hull City tracksuit. I would go to school wearing my football kit under my school uniform. Bearing in mind I was 12, not many girls at the age of 12 would do that nowadays. I was now winning every judo competition entered. Within the AGA, the Amateur Judo Association, I was advised to join the British Judo Association to give me the opportunity to progress my sport further. I moved to Kingston Judo Club under the instruction of Mike Joyce, who was the coach. But I still played for Hull Brewery, women's football team, and also had trials for England football. Judo was now taking over. I gained a place on the Great Britain Judo squad under the instruction of the great Roy Inman, who later in life was to become my father-in-law. I travelled to London to train every weekend. My first international, age 17 in Canada. Times were hard for my parents. I was the fifth child along the line. I think my parents were getting a little bit fed up by this stage. I remember this well. I had a duffel coat and a suitcase. The rest of the British team had sports jackets and sports bags. But nevertheless, I was the only one to win the gold medal. The world's coming up in 1982, the World Judo Championships. Had to beat the current world champion from UK to be selected. It was a fight. I was a fighter and my determination was immense. I was going to do this and I did. I was selected for the Worlds age 18 in Paris. Family, coaches, everybody came to watch me. I just took it as another competition. Four fights later, I was in the final versus the French girl. The sound was immense from a packed stadium. I won. I was world champion at only 18. I then set my goal higher to become 3 times world champion. Judo was not included in the Olympics yet, but I need to move on. I have only 10 minutes to read this to you. I struggled to find financial backing, but judo and training was my life. I returned world champion to find my unemployment benefit had been stopped whilst I was out of the country. I then worked at Woodford Leisure Centre, helped by the Hull City Council, as I trained full time. I then moved to London, where my training was based, and Peter Inman was my training partner, who also later in life became my wonderful husband. I was world champion in 1982, 84, and 86. Qualifying event demonstration Judo Olympics was an event that was put into the program in 1987 because it was only a demonstration event, hoping to get it included for 1992. I entered the 1987 World Championships. As in my first fight, I competed against an American girl, and she, many people would say accidentally, stepped onto the back of my leg. I would have had probably different opinion to that. But my leg was stepped onto the back, and as I tried to stand up, as I could not have a medical attention, would have meant me being disqualified. It felt like my leg went through a hole in the judo mat. I was taken to hospital in Germany, operated on immediately. For the first time in my life, I felt frightened, as my dad had to sign a form to give the surgeons permission, if necessary, to amputate my leg, because it was so severely broken in 5 places, and a compound fracture, which eventually had to be pinned. I was now 3 times world champion, but I was not ready to quit. Being told by the surgeon I would be lucky to walk again, determination is so great. It took me 1.5 years to recover. Yes, I was back aiming for the worlds in 1989. A very difficult year for me. My mum Elsie passed away, only age 59. I was devastated. I focused only on becoming world champion again, a title which I owned and wanted back. And yes, I did it. I became 4 times world champion. Aiming now for the Olympics, although coming towards the end of my career, as I was a lightweight, the Commonwealth Games 1990 was another excellent event for myself. I won gold and I was selected over Seb Coe to carry the England flag, a massive achievement for myself and for the sport of judo. 1982 Olympic Games in Barcelona, I was favourite, always going well. I was now in the semi-final, but dislocated my shoulder in the fight prior to getting there. I was struggling. Physio gave injections, everything possible, to get me through this semi-final. My shoulder dislocated approximately 7 times. I had to put it back in, as if a doctor came on, I would be disqualified. Adrenaline is brilliant when you need it. Oh. I lost because of my injury. I was absolutely gutted. I also came out to fight for the bronze with one arm. Maybe not a sensible idea, but judo was my life. I was placed 5th in the Olympics. Injuries in sport can never be predicted. I had to pick myself up and rethink my life. I now had a sponsorship deal, but I had to be 3 times world champion before I gained any financial help. I decided I was now going to call it a day. I have had a great career and wanted to start a family. I married the love of my life, Pete Inman, in 1994, and we have 2 wonderful, talented, and successful children. Jade, age 21, who was also on the Great Britain Judo squad for 9 years, and she's actually sitting here, and became 2 times British champion herself. Harry, age 19, a rugby player, took his own steps in life to move away from judo to rugby, gained a scholarship with All Kingston Rovers, but has now returned to judo. Life has been great. I would not change my life for anything in the world. I've wrote a book, had a play in Hull wrote about me, gained my MBE in 1990, gained a doctorate from the Hull University, and been inducted into the Hall of Fame in Astana, Kazakhstan, in 2015. Me and my husband, Pete, we now teach judo to school, to pupils in schools around the Hull. We teach approximately 250 children a week, of which half are girls, which is great to give back to the sport. We have also produced British champions and international players at the judo club. I thank all my family for the support over the years, and I also thank the City of Hull and the WOW Festival for inviting me to tell my story. And I just hope you've all really enjoyed it. I've had a fulfilled life and absolutely enjoyed every bit of it. Thank you for listening.
Thank you. What an inspirational story. Thank you so much, Karen. Stories of resilient women in Hull. Is it something in the water? Extraordinary. We have real stories of real women, like Karen, like Barbara Buttrick, who's the generation before, some of the other historical women, contemporary women. Stories of women are so important. But where we don't have factual stories, we can have fictional stories. So our next speaker is Val Wood, that much-loved author of historical romantic novels. Val's stories encompass women who are winners and also women who are not winners. Great romantic stories and quite often great tragedies. And so I'd like now to invite Val to give us her 10 minutes, our wow bite. Thank you, Val Wood.
Thank you. Thank you very much. My goodness, Karen, I'd rather not be after you. I'd rather come before you. What a story. Wonderful. I might use that one day. Once upon a time, haven't most of us at some time used that phrase when we're telling a story, listening to a story, reading a story? That's how I like to start. I have been doing that for as long as I can remember. And in fact, when I was a very small child, my mother said that when I was very little, I don't remember it, I used to sit on the stairs and talk to an imaginary friend. And this is what I still do, except I don't sit on the stairs. I generally sit at my desk and type. Imagination is, for me, a great source of inspiration. I was born in Castleford in West Riding of Yorkshire, so I'm Yorkshire through and through. And I spent my formative years in that town. My mother and I and my then one baby sister lived with my granny, my mother's mother, when my father went off to be a soldier. And my mother became the main breadwinner, as so many women did during that very hard, difficult wartime. In Granny's terraced house, there was no electricity. She lived in a rented terraced house just down the hill from the pit head. She had no electricity, only gaslight and a candle to light us to bed. Can you imagine doing that today with your children, letting them go upstairs with a lighted candle? I don't think so. We weren't deprived, never felt deprived. Granny had a huge range in her kitchen, always coal, because one of her sons was a coal miner and she got a load of coal. And she used to bake. She used to bake bread every week, roast beef and Yorkshire pudding in the oven. And we had a normal, ordinary childhood, for we escaped the war in Castleford. We could hear the planes going overhead on their way to the industrial towns of Leeds and Bradford, but nothing much happened in Castleford. One of my earliest recollections was hearing the ring of the miners' clogs as they went up the hill to the pit for their morning shift. And then a little later in the day, the sound again of the others coming down. There were no pit head baths then, and the men had to come home for their bath in the tin tub in front of the fire. And often I used to see them sitting on their doorsteps, still in their blackened clothes, their sooty, grimed faces, and usually smoking a roll-up and waiting for their wives to fill the tin tub in front of the fire for their scrub down. So imagination. I wrote a story about our neighbour. He's sitting like a little black bird on his doorstep. I wrote a story about that long, long before I was published. So imaginations for me has been, well, just wonderful, really. Sometimes it's said that children's imagination disappears once they reach adulthood, and mine never did. It was always there. And also it's said that it sometimes is an escapism. Well, I don't think it was for me. I can't recall any worries at that time. I wasn't deprived. I was an only child at that time. But I had cousins who lived nearby, and eventually I had a sister. So I don't think it was anything like that. I didn't feel as if I was escaping from the real world. In 2014, I left the English shores and went in search of adventure. With a friend, I travelled on a ferry to Le Havre, caught a train to Rouen, and then on to Paris, where we stayed a few days sightseeing, you know, the usual thing, Montmartre, the Louvre, Champs-Élysées, and then on to beautiful Switzerland, and finally travelled across the Alps on horseback and into Italy, and had a simply wonderful time. That last sentence, in case you haven't spotted it, is totally, utterly untrue. I didn't do that. I was sitting at my desk writing Every Mother's Son, but I was travelling in my head with my fictional characters, with Daniel, with Beatrice and her brother Charles. And I sat in the pouring rain, I could see it through my window, and I was in sunshine, and it was brilliant. So that's one of the good things about having an imagination. So for me, it has always been a saving grace, an escapism, if you like. And the reason why? Well, to go back a few years for when I was very young and in primary school still, and my teacher said to me one day, "What is in that head of yours, Valerie?" Well, it wasn't anything he was telling me, but there was some bright spark, a boy sitting on the back row with his nice swept back blonde hair, his tie and his blazer, and he shouted out, "Sawdust, sir." Now, how come I've remembered that all those years? But my education was dire. I failed my 11 plus twice, so that was a great achievement, wasn't it? And one of the things which happened next, well, take this as you will, but my mother, in her wisdom, and for reasons best known to her, was that she booked me in for a course as a mannequin. Today they're models. I discovered later that models at that time actually meant something else entirely. It meant taking your clothes off. We didn't have to do that. What we had to do was to walk tall with a book on our heads and learn about makeup and showing off beautiful but totally inaccessible clothes for us, or certainly for me. I think my mother maybe thought, perhaps, well, she's not going to be an academic, perhaps this will be the way forward. And I think the changing in women today, they can expect, they did expect not to be able to do anything very much. And certainly I had no ambition to do anything. But then I was locked in my head as a dreaming child. We left Castleford when my father came home after the war and came to Hull, where he worked as a war damage assessor, assessing all the damage which was extreme in Hull after the war. And I do wonder, really, when I think about it, because even when I started work several years later, there was still a lot of bombed out buildings and bomb sites. And I wondered if perhaps that started off as a trigger, the fact that I wondered what had been on those bomb sites and in those buildings with their shattered windows and doors off, and wondering what had been before. But at that time, I wasn't doing any research because I was busy working in a fashion house, and at last my mannequin training came in very useful because we had, you won't remember this, any of you, but the New York Ballroom on Anlaby Road was the most beautiful place. And we did our modelling sessions there. We held two, sometimes three, fashion shows a year. And we had a catwalk and flowers and a real live orchestra. And that was lovely. I really enjoyed that. But I'm going to skip most of my early career and jump to when I married my lovely husband, Peter, too, and had two daughters. And I did voluntary work, most of my life I've done voluntary work. But when my daughters went off to university, and I was so thrilled about that, it was a time then for me to think, so what's happening next? What do I do now? We lived out in Holderness. We had a very old house with a huge rambling garden, and my imagination then could soar. And I was still writing stories. When the girls were young, of course, I wrote short stories for them because I had ready listeners who couldn't escape. And so I wrote children's stories then, and even joined How to Write Children's Stories. But that didn't last long because they didn't like my ideas of dragons and pixies and magic. Strange how things can change, isn't it? So I decided I would go back and do adult education, and so that's what I did. I went to do what I loved most of all, and that is English and writing essays. And I decided, I did well with it, and then I thought, so maybe next I'll try for a degree. That would be great. I would do humanities, which would incorporate English. But, you know, there's a saying by Rabbi Burns. I'll tell you what it is in a minute. We'll find the right page. Anyway, what it is, it's so much for the ideas of mice and men. Sometimes they go astray. And mine did then, because things happened within my family and it wasn't going to be possible to go to university and read 8 books and study 8 books. But Daphne Glaser, who is speaking elsewhere today or tomorrow, she was running a writer's workshop in the old Spring Street Theatre. And I thought, that will suit me. I can work to my own timetable and write stories. And this is what I did for something like 10 years. Now, I've not been an overnight success, have I? 10 years, and I loved it, being with like-minded people, sending off pieces of prose, short stories to writers' magazines, sending short stories to people like Women's Own, and so on. And all rejected. Never, ever published anything. Until one day I had this idea, driving through Holderness, where the cliffs were falling at Mapleton. And here, I thought, is my trigger. Here's a story. And it was a big story which grew and grew and grew. Am I still all right for time? And that story took me 2.5 years to write because it became a novel, not a short story. And someone was persuaded me to go then and enter it for the Catherine Cookson Fiction Prize. And the rest, as we say, is history. My books have been in Sunday Times bestseller list. They have sold, well, a lot of them. And it is the most satisfying career I can ever think of. What I want to say before I finish is, don't think that you must have a university degree to be able to write or be a novelist. You don't. You don't have to be young, although it's nice if you are. You've got a long, long career in front of you. You can start at any age you want. But just do what you like to do and be happy with that. I am so happy with my career. Can't think there's anything else I would want to do. But then on the other hand, I just might. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Val. I think this pressure to do everything in the right order is particularly a pressure that comes to women, doesn't it? You're supposed to be having your children and going to university and setting yourself up and buying a house and all of these things that you're supposed to do. And actually, for women, because there are certain things that do have to happen at certain times biologically, everything's now getting crammed and squashed, and we have these vastly pressurized 30s and early 40s, which is incredibly difficult. But our next speaker, thinking about imagination and reinvention, Our next speaker seems to have reinvented herself every 10 years and is an absolute role model for that. A lifelong learner as well, I think.
Still learning.
In the same way that many of our speakers today have spoken about, get that education. There's never too late to go and get that education. It's never too late to enter into the learning world. So our next speaker is going to talk to us about her experience. So please do welcome Nancy Burt-Wessel.
Thank you. Right. I need a little bit of room, do you know what I mean? I find that if I'm in a chair or I'm I need a bit of room to move about, so I've just moved my chair back a bit. Have we any Bake Off fans in, by the way? Marvellous, marvellous. Have we got any Apprentice fans? Apprentice, a little bit? Strictly? Strictly, yeah. Right. So if I tell you that the final of The Apprentice, the year I was on Bake Off, got 9 million viewers, and the winner got £250,000. The Strictly final that year got 11 million viewers, and the winner of Strictly gets £100,000. And the year I won Bake Off, there were 13.5 million, and I read somewhere it was 1 in 5 of the population watched the final, and I got this. and a bunch of flowers. But having said that, it has been and still is absolutely marvellous. Talk about life changing. I mean, it's been put I worked 32 years full time in the health service. I did a degree. In fact, the last time I was in this building on that stage was 20 years ago, getting my MBA from Sir David Putnam, I think. And I was so scared. But anyway, you don't realise how lucky you are to have me here. Because as part of the audition process for Bake Off, there was something like 8 or 10, whether it be an audition, a telephone interview, form filling, all that sort of thing. But my first big audition was in Manchester. And I remember it as plain as anything. It was Friday the 13th of December. And I'd had a telephone interview, I'd filled in my form, and then I got this phone call saying, will you come to Manchester for your first audition? So I said, yeah, what do I have to do? Bring two of your favourite bakes. So if you bring a cake, your second bake couldn't be another cake. It had to be bread or pastry, something like that. So I was so excited. But of course, all along the way, you're told, oh, this is a secret. You can't tell anybody. So obviously the family knew. Well, I didn't even tell all the family, but that's another story. I've only got 10 minutes. Usually I have an hour to tell you all this. So there's so many other things. But anyway, I've got my two bags of baking. Because it was the 13th of December, we had some friends coming for supper, so my husband stayed at home because we couldn't tell them that I had an audition, so he stayed at home putting the Christmas tree up and getting a meal ready. And he said, Nancy, when you get to Piccadilly Station, does anybody know Manchester very well, by the way? Mm. I don't, right? And he said to me, when you get to Piccadilly Station, get in a taxi, because this audition was at the conference centre, right? So I get to Piccadilly Station. I've got my two bags of baking, all carefully. You can imagine you don't want anything to break. I'd taken lemon meringue tart and bacon croissant. I thought that would get them. So I had these two bags of baking, got off the train at Piccadilly, saw the taxi, the thing for taxi, but then I saw another sign that said free bus. Now, being a lass from Hull, you're going to understand. Why would anybody get a taxi if there's a free bus, right? So I went over to the free bus stop, and there was another lady standing there in this little bus, you know the type I mean, a sort of 20-seater bus. And she was standing there, and I said to her, will this bus take me to the conference centre? So she said, oh, yeah, I get off the stop after. So she said, I'll tell you exactly where to get off. So I thought, this is a no-brainer. I'll get on this bus. So I got on the bus and I sat next to her and I was busting. I said, I'm really not supposed to say anything, but I said, I've got an audition for the Great British Bake Off. She said, that's marvellous. It's my favourite programme. I said, I can't believe it. And so I'm on this bus. So she, do you want to be off here? Walk down and then you'll see these big steps and that's where you want to be. My appointment was 10 o'clock. It was about 25 to, everything swimmingly, going really well. Got off the bus, went up the steps. I was a little bit put off because it was a building a bit like this and there were signs everywhere for the Guinness exhibition. But I thought, well, you know, there might be a little room somewhere where they're doing the bake-off. And so anyway, I went up these stairs, went to reception. I said, it's Nancy Birtwistle here. I've come for my audition. So she, what for? So I said, the Great British Bake Off, the audition here today. Not here, duck. No, no. I said, is this the conference centre? So she said, no, no, this is the convention centre. So I said, right, so you know that awful, awful thing. What am I going to do? It's now 9:45. I said, I thought, calm. How far is the conference centre from here? Can I walk it? She said, it's too far to walk. So I said, right, can you just ring me a taxi? I can't ring you a taxi, no, I can't ring you a taxi. You might get one outside the Midland Hotel. So I said, where's the Midland Hotel? She said, just down there, it's not far. So I can't describe how dreadful I felt. I was flustered and my hair had come out and my baking felt heavy. And I ran down to the Midland Hotel and there was a taxi parked outside. So I said, you have no idea how stressed I am. I said, I need to be at the conference centre for 10 o'clock. Can you get me there? He said, I'll get you there, love. Get in. So I got in this taxi. It drove me, it seemed like forever. I pulled outside of this building that was the conference centre. He charged me 15 quid, right? And I said to him, before I got out the taxi, can you just explain to me, when I come out of here, where's Piccadilly Station? He said, it's just there, love. It's just there. So me chasing a free bus ended up costing me 15 quid, but it also ended up getting me noticed because I walked into this bake-off audition and a mess. And I said, and I walked in there and I said, you lot have no idea how lucky you are to have me here. They wanted to keep me at the Guinness exhibition. And apparently that got me a big tick. But anyway, so what's Bake Off done? It's taken me as far north as the Shetland Islands. I was on board entertainment on a cruise. mind you, they're all about 80, but anyway. And as far south as Cornwall at the Eagle Project, which is an amazing place. But it is a long way to go, isn't it? It took about 5 hours in the car. And lots of great things. And people say to me, I was told when I won, you'll be offered all sorts of things. You'll be able to demonstrate, write recipes, write a book, go into schools, after dinner speaking. And I said, well, it's all brand new. I have absolutely no idea. So I'll give it all a go. And actually, I like doing all of it. If I had to make wedding cakes all day, it'd drive me nuts. But I like making wedding cakes, but two or three a year. I like demonstrating. I wouldn't want to do it all the time. I like after dinner speak. I just love the richness that it's given me. And what I've just started, I must tell you about that. If anybody's on social media, I am gifting, and this isn't a con, I am gifting for a whole year. It's called 365 Challenge, that's what you do now, isn't it? Hashtag 365 Challenge, and every day for a year, I'm on about day 32, I think, I am gifting all my recipes, my tips, my hints, my videos of how to do things. And people have said to me, why are you just gifting it away? And I said, well, I could be dead tomorrow, or I could be dead next week. Realistically, I could. And I think, well, how often do you say, I wish I still had my granny here to ask her something, or I wish I still had my mother here. She would have known the answer to that. And I think, well, at my age, I have got a wealth of knowledge and experience gained mostly through making hellish mistakes.
And I've been documenting it all and writing recipes. I've got 500 recipes to give out. And I thought that's a way of, and actually the National Press have got hold of it. So tomorrow I should be in the Nationals, I think, over this 365 challenge. And I've got lots of funny stories, but one, how am I doing for time?
2 minutes.
Yeah, well, I'll just finish off with this funny story because people, I think it's hilarious, but anyway, people say to me, what's it like to be a celebrity? And I honestly used to believe it. And you remember Extra Slice, the program that partners Bake Off? Well, the year I was on, because it's in front of a live audience, a studio audience, and mine was recorded at Pinewood Studios, but because they didn't want any spoilers in the audience to say who the winner was going to be, they actually recorded the final Extra Slice on the day that the final went out on the telly, which was the Wednesday night, 8th of October. And that Wednesday morning, we recorded Extra Slice, which meant had to be in London the night before, Tuesday. So because the three finalists were in London on the Tuesday night, they said, oh, we'll have you on the one show. So I thought, oh, that's a good opportunity. That's an exciting thing. So the three of us, me, Louis and Richard, put in a taxi from Pinewood Studios over to BBC Broadcasting House in central London. And when we got there, I kid you not, there were paparazzi everywhere. Everywhere outside the entrance. And Louis said to me, "Gee, I didn't expect this." So I said, "I don't know, you know, we're finalists, you know. It's a lot of people are going to watch this program. There's a lot of hype about it." So they said, "Oh, you get out, Nancy, first. You go first because you're the girl anyway, and you need to go out, and then we'll get out and follow you." So I said, "Right." So I got out of this taxi, and I am not exaggerating here. I got out and I posed. So I got out the taxi. And sort of went like this. Not a single camera flashed. Not one. And then this guy said to me, "Can you just please move out the way because we're waiting for Cheryl Cole." So if anybody says to me, what's it like to be a celebrity? I say, the celebrity, I'm the celebrity, and I'm not a celebrity. And thank you very much for listening.
Thank you, Nancy, and I think your cake stands lovely. So, thank you for sharing the stories. Leon, Karen, Val, and Nancy, please give them a huge round of applause. Today has been very much about sharing stories. I hope that we will carry on sharing the stories. I know that Henrietta's got a few things that she's going to tell us about, some programming that's coming up this afternoon. Our panelists, we don't have time for a Q&A, but our panelists are going to be around if you'd like to ask them for any questions, or if you've got anything particular you'd like to share with them. They've very kindly said that they'll stay for a little bit and just be around in the auditorium here for a few minutes. Thank you all for coming. My name's Anna Farthing. I think I'm done for the day. But I'm going to hand over now to Henrietta Duckworth, who's our executive producer.
Hello, just a few notices then. Thank you very much. Val, I believe you will be proceeding to the Waterstones in the...
I've been waiting now.
That's great. So there's, okay. If you've got your books or if you'd like to buy some new ones, Val will be signing. We've also got Gemma Kenny on this stage at 2 o'clock and Kate Fox performing her brand new radio piece in the Victoria Bar. That's the bar looking over Queen Victoria Square at 2:30 p.m. And I just want to give a heads up. You've seen all the amazing craftivism that's been going on around. You can see our columns, they're pinned with handmade. I think we've got about 800 handmade craft items now, all giving badges and messages. These are going to be given away, because the whole idea is that this is they've been created by individuals to give to other people. So at 3:30 p.m., we will be having a wrap-up session, and that will be the moment when we have the great craft giveaway, the great revolutionary maker giveaway. So please stay for that, and you can take a little piece of wow with you this weekend. Who's played darts before? Who wants to learn how to play darts? Did you ever think you might play darts in City Hall? No, everything can happen at WOW. Behind you, as you get up now, you will now discover that a dart board has been erected so that we can all play darts. It's very, very exciting. So our team, there they are, they're going to welcome you. So please go and have a go, go and play some darts. And then miraculously, after a short period of time playing darts, our Ruby Reds will be joining us for one last time, one special performance on this stage before the end of the afternoon. So please look out for the Ruby Reds. Thank you very much. I think those are all my main notices. So we've got darts, we've got Gemma Kearney, we've got Kate Fox. And if you're looking for Dr. Comfort Momo, she's just about to start in the Mortimer West room talking about her work preventing FGM. Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, if you do want to talk to Nancy, Leanne and Karen, they are here to my right. Perhaps we can keep the house lights up, actually. The lights up here so we can all see each other a bit. Thank you very much. That's great. So Karen, Dr. Karen Briggs, Nancy Birtwistle and Leon are all here if you'd like to have a word. Take advantage of these moments. They happen very rarely. Thank you very much. Until the next point.